This is Henry Simon, bringing you another story from my files here at the Missing Persons Bureau.
In these stories of the Missing Persons Bureau, dramatized for Henry Simon by Ross Napier, names and addresses have, for obvious reasons, been changed. In one moment, the search for Ronald Marsden, address unknown. And here again is Henry Simon.
The year is 1952. The scene is the main entrance to Charing Cross Railway Station in London. It is 9:45 on a Tuesday morning in June. And near the central ticket barrier, a tall man in a navy suit leans heavily against a stone pillar. Hands thrust deep into his trousers pockets, he's smoking a pipe and seems to be quite unaware that he's being observed by a uniformed police officer who at length approaches him and, after hesitating for a moment, taps him on the shoulder.
Excuse me, sir. I hope you don't mind me accosting you like this. I was wondering if I could be of any assistance.
Assistance?
Well, every morning for the past week or so, I've noticed you standing here in the same place, leaning against this very same pillar, just like you are now. Well, I don't mind admitting you've had me curious.
Well, I never dreamt I was attracting the attention of the law.
Would I be correct in assuming... You're a visitor to London?
You would be. I'm from Canada. Over here on a business trip.
I see.
You're not going to book me for loitering, I trust?
No, sir, nothing like that. Oh, it's just that we have orders to be helpful to people whenever possible.
And I look as if I need help. Is that it?
Well, if you'll forgive my saying so, sir. Yes, sir. You do, rather.
Perhaps you're right.
If there's anything I can do, I'll be only
You're very kind, Constable, but I'm afraid the sort of help I need is a little out of your domain.
But, sir?
I'm looking for my son.
Your son?
Ronald. He'd be about your age, roughly the same build. In fact, you look something like him.
Well, I don't think I quite follow, sir.
Do you have a son, Constable?
Oh, no, sir. I'm not married.
Then you wouldn't know what it feels like to be a father.
Has he been missing long?
Long enough. A few months, over 10 years, to be exact.
10 years?
He was in the Air Force during the war. The Canadian Air Force, that is. In 1941, he was posted over here. He never came back.
Well, you haven't kept in touch?
No. But I know he's in London somewhere.
Perhaps if you tried the military authorities, they might be able to help.
I've already tried him.
No luck?
None at all. You see, Constable, according to the official records, my son is dead.
Such was the prelude to a case that had its beginning for us here at the Missing Persons Bureau some 3 days later. And I was visited in my office by a man who gave his name as Philip Marsden, and then went on to describe the incident which I have just recounted, identifying himself as the Canadian who had lost his son.
That's correct, Mr. Simon. As I told the constable, Ronald is officially dead. I'm afraid I rather confused the poor fellow.
In fact, I'm a trifle confused myself, Mr. Marsden. If your son's death has been confirmed by the military authorities, what to lead you to suppose that he might still be alive?
There's no maybe about it. He is alive.
Why are you so sure?
2 weeks ago, I saw him with my own eyes.
What, here in London?
Outside Charing Cross Station. He passed through the main ticket barrier less than 10 feet from me. I was going in. He was coming out.
You didn't speak to him?
I didn't have a chance. It was the rush hour. There were people milling everywhere. Before I could get my breath back, I'd lost him in the crowd. Every morning since then, I've taken up a position near the barrier, hoping to catch sight of him again, but so far, he hasn't shown up.
There's always the chance that you were mistaken.
I tell you, it was Ronald. I'm as certain of that as I am of my own sanity. I was almost as close to him as I am to you now. If we both stretched our arms out, we could have touched hands.
Did he see you?
No, he was looking in the opposite direction.
Did you see him full face or just his profile?
Full face.
He served in the Canadian Air Force during the war, you say?
He was a fighter pilot.
What are the circumstances of his reported death?
He was shot down over France. According to the records, his plane exploded in midair before he could bail out.
Were there any eyewitnesses?
Yes, two. An RAF squadron leader and another Canadian boy. They were flying together in a group on their way back to base. Mm-hmm. Right smack into a pack of Messerschmitts. Well, from what I can gather, they were outnumbered by about 5-1 and low on fuel to boot. They had to make a run for it.
And?
The other two got through. Ronnie caught a burst in his fuel tank.
Did they actually see the plane explode?
Apparently.
But they didn't happen to see him bail out?
No.
I see. And this was in 1942?
March 16th.
Was no trace of his body ever recovered?
If his body had been recovered, I wouldn't be here.
Now, what I meant was, no body was ever discovered that was presumed to be his.
Not that I know of.
But were you given no reason at all to believe that he might have survived?
None whatever.
Well, then, on the strength of the official report, you accepted the fact of his death?
Absolutely. In view of the circumstances, I could do little else.
And yet now, 10 years later, you're prepared to wave all that aside because of a momentary glimpse you caught of a man coming out of Charing Cross Station?
For the simple reason that the man was Ronald.
But if he's dead, how could it have been?
Quite obviously, he's not dead.
In that case, why hasn't he made any sort of move to contact you? Let you know that he's still alive.
That I can't tell you. I can only repeat what I've already said. There's no doubt in my mind whatever that the man I saw was my son.
Very well, assuming that he wasn't killed. For argument's sake, let's say that he did manage to bail out of his plane unobserved and somehow managed to make his way back to this country. Are you asking me to believe that he would make no effort at all to inform the authorities about his presence here?
I'm not asking you to believe anything. I'm simply stating the truth as I know it.
How close were you to him? Emotionally, I mean.
Just about as close as a father could be, I guess.
You were good friends?
The best.
I take it he wasn't married.
No, he was only 22 when he went overseas.
Well, that'll make him 32 now.
33.
Before he joined the Air Force, did he have a job?
He was at the university.
Studying what?
Law.
He didn't qualify?
No, he missed the finals by about 6 months. His mother and I begged him to stay on till he was through, but he'd made up his mind to enlist. There was nothing we could do to stop him.
I see. Don't happen to have a photograph of him, I suppose?
Fortunately, I carry one in my wallet.
Oh, yes, thank you.
It's quite a good snap, actually, taken just before he left.
Fine-looking boy.
He inherited his mother's looks.
Is she in London with you?
Not this trip. I left a home in Toronto.
Do you have any other children?
A younger daughter. She married an American, lives in New York.
You've been in touch with your wife about this, I suppose?
No, as a matter of fact, I haven't.
Why not?
I wanted to find him first. It's no use, Mr. Simon. If you're trying to trap me into admitting doubt, you're wasting your time.
So it would seem.
Well, do you take the case or don't you?
First, I'd rather like to discuss it with my assistant.
Fair enough. Will that take long?
He's in his office now. If you don't mind just waiting outside for a few moments, I'll send for him right away.
This is a new twist, Chief. You asking my advice on whether or not to accept the case.
Well, I think, Study, you'll agree that the circumstances are rather exceptional. In any event, you're the one who's going to have to handle it.
Yeah, that's what bothers me. You figure there's any chance the guy he saw really was his son?
Oh, frankly, I'd say the odds were a million to one against it. On the other hand, I did all in my power to instill some sort of doubt into his mind, and he wouldn't budge. As far as he's concerned, the boy is still alive, and that's all there is to it. We could both talk as a little blue in the face. Wouldn't do us the slightest bit of good.
Yeah, but, Chief, even so, I'm up to my ears as it is. I don't want to take on something that's just going to waste my time.
Well, it's up to you to decide. Hunter's due back from Vienna in the morning. That ought to take some of the pressure off your shoulders. But don't let it influence your decision. You do whatever you think best.
He's, waiting outside, huh?
Mm-hmm. I told him we'd only be here. A few minutes.
Well, there's only one sure way to settle it. I'll flip a coin.
Hardly an ethical approach.
Maybe not ethical, but practical. Now, heads we take it, tails we don't. Heads we take it.
I'll call him in.
Yeah, I should have known better. Never won a toss in my life.
And thus it was decided that we should accept the assignment. I'd hasten to point out, however, that never before or since have I allowed my judgment to be swayed by the mere face of a coin. However, if nothing else, of course, it settled the issue. And that very same afternoon, Surrey set the wheels of the investigation in motion by calling in at the office of Major Ralph Thomas of Military Intelligence, who, of course, is a very old and most trusted associate of ours, and who has rendered us invaluable assistance on many occasions in the past, and who, in this particular instance, was very quick to come up with the information which we wanted.
Here we are, Ma. Marsden, Ronald Stewart, Flight Lieutenant, Royal Canadian Air Force.
Yeah, that's our boy.
Killed in action March 16th,
1942. Well, that sounds definite enough.
Let's see now. Report appears to be based solely on the two eyewitness accounts.
That's the men who were flying with him at the time, huh?
Yes. Flight Lieutenant Aubrey Evans, Canadian Air Force, also killed in action. April 27th, 42, about 6 weeks later.
What about the other one, the RAF guy?
Squadron leader Douglas Herring, DFC. Herring, know that name? Of course. Dalton Aircraft. He's one of our top test pilots.
Dalton, huh?
Hmm. Main plant's at Richmond. You'll probably get him there.
Yeah, they've got an office in town. I'll check with him. Not that there's very much point to it. He can only tell me what I already know. Hey, let me give you a piece of solid advice, Major. When you're in two minds about a thing, never flip a coin.
Henry Simon returns to continue this story in just a moment. And here again is Henry Simon.
At the Dalton Aircraft Plant and Testing Center in Richmond, Study duly made the acquaintance of one Douglas Herring, who was the former RAF squadron leader and was now employed by Dalton as a test pilot. A short man with curly red hair and a closely trimmed moustache to match, he greeted the agent with a handshake, which the latter swears almost cracked his knuckles, and ushered him into the staff bar, where they immediately settled down to a couple of pints of the best brown ale.
Good stuff, old lad, what?
Yeah, I've tasted worse.
Special brew. Now then, what's all this about young Ronnie Marsden?
You remember him?
Well, grand chap he was, had the makings of a first-rate pilot. Too bad he had to get it when he did, only a youngster, too.
You were with him at the time, I believe.
That's right.
Well, I've read your report on what happened, but I'd kind of like to hear it. You tell it yourself, if it's not too much trouble.
Not at all, old boy. Perfectly simple, really. He copped a lolly in his fuel tank, and up went the works.
Before he could bail out, eh?
Presumably.
Why, presumably?
Well, stands to reason, old son. If he could have, he would have. The fact he didn't clearly indicates it was all over before he knew what it was all about.
Did you actually see the plane hit?
No, he was below me.
Well, what did you see, then?
The flash of the explosion. That's about all there was to see.
And you'd be prepared to swear it was instantaneous?
Well, I wouldn't swear to anything, but I'd say it was a pretty safe bet.
There was another guy with you, wasn't there?
Old Orb Evans. We flew as a trio quite a lot. We were developing a system.
What did he have to say about it?
His report tallied with mine in every detail.
On paper, sure, but off the record.
My dear old boy, he saw no more and no less than I did. As I said, there was nothing more to see. The kite simply blew up.
Would it have been possible for Marsden to have jumped out without either of you spotting him?
Oh, hardly.
Well, just supposing he'd had the time.
But we've already established that he didn't.
No, on the contrary. A pretty safe bet was the phrase you used. That's by no means conclusive.
Look here, old lad, exactly what is it you're trying to prove?
Well, Marsden's father claims his son is still alive.
Still alive?
Uh-huh.
That's preposterous. He couldn't be.
You try convincing the old man.
Study, dear friend. I can tell you now you're wasting your talent.
Undoubtedly. But you still haven't answered my question. If he'd had the time, could he have bailed out without you or Evans seeing him?
Well, visibility wasn't the best, as I recall. There were quite a few patches of cloud about. added to which we both had our hands pretty full. Yes, I suppose he could have, but I'd be willing to stake my own life on the fact that he didn't. At this juncture, I could use another pint. Same for you?
No, thanks. I've had my quarter for the day, but the shout's on me. You go right ahead. Well, that's it, Chief. You can draw your own conclusions.
I've already done so, Study. I must say, there seems to be some sort of element of doubt, faint though it may be.
Yeah, so faint it's practically non-existent.
Even so, it swings the scale slightly more in favor of our client.
Doesn't swing him against him, anyway. Question is, where do we go from here?
Well, to my mind, there's only one place we can go. That's Charing Cross Station.
How do you mean?
Well, it seems to me that our best course is to try to find the man that Marsden saw.
Yeah?
He went through the central ticket barrier during the morning rush hour, which would seem to indicate that he was actually on his way to work, somewhere in or around Strand.
Check.
That in itself, of course, is another point in favor of Marsden.
How come?
Well, because before he left Canada, the boy was studying law.
So?
And the Strand, of course, is dotted with legal offices.
Hey, I never thought of that.
Again, it's extremely remote, but it does tie in. At all events, it's well worth following up.
In other words, you want I should go the rounds of every legal office in the area.
Unless you've got anything else to suggest.
If I did, we could toss for it, huh?
Oh, shouldn't be that big a job. At least it's confined to the environs of the Strand.
Don't kid yourself. A guy can get corns in the Strand, same as any place else. Only advantage is, if they get too bad, I can always duck down a side street and bathe them in the Thames.
With the aid of a classified directory, Study drew up a very comprehensive list of every legal office in the vicinity of Charing Cross Station. And then, equipped with a photograph of Ronald Marsden, he duly set out on his task, commencing at Trafalgar Square and then gradually working his way up toward Fleet Street. Altogether, he had 62 names on his list, the first 15 of which were complete blanks. Number 16, Hogarth and Randall solicitors, was located in the Price Building, which was directly across from the Strand Palace Hotel. There, among others, he questioned Alice Longdon, a pretty stenographer come receptionist, who gazed at the photograph for some moments, her brow furrowed in thought.
I've seen that face somewhere before. I'm almost sure of it.
Well, the guy I'm after is a good deal older. This was taken over 10 years ago.
I still think I've seen him. The nose and that mouth, they're very distinctive. Oh, if only I could... Wait a bit now. Yes, I remember. He came in here with Mr. Matheson about 6 weeks ago, it must have been.
Matheson?
Of Matheson and Gilders. He had some papers for Mr. Randall. He left them with me.
You mean Matheson?
Yes.
And the guy here was with him, huh?
Well, if it wasn't him, it was someone very like him. But I'd suggest you get in touch with Mr. Matheson. He should know.
In point of fact, the office of Matheson and Gilders was the next but three on Study's list. And 5 minutes later, the agent was ushered into the presence of the senior partner, Walter Matheson himself. A pleasant man with an easy manner, the latter received him most cordially.
From Missing Persons Bureau, yes. Read quite a bit about you people. I must confess you had me curious.
Well, there's nothing much to it, sir. All I want you to do, if you can, is to identify the fellow in this photograph. Actually, it was Miss Longdon of Hogarth and Randall who put me on to you. She seemed to think she saw him in your company when you dropped in at their office a while back.
Yes, looks rather like Barney Austin.
Barney Austin?
The younger version.
Well, this was taken back around 1940.
Well, there's certainly a strong resemblance. Now, I think that he did come up to Hogarth and Randall's with me one afternoon on our way to down to the club.
Well, who is he exactly?
Can't tell you much about his personal life. He's a barrister by profession. Has chambers in the Rothmore Building.
And how old would he be?
Early 30s, perhaps.
You know anything about his background?
Afraid not. I can only tell you he has a slight American-sounding accent. Where he comes from, I couldn't say.
At the chambers of Barnett Austin on the third floor of the Rothmore Building, Sally was told by Pert Blonde, who sat at a desk in the outer office, that her employer was in court and was not expected back for at least an hour. Accordingly, the agent settled down to wait.
The minutes went by, and it was well into the second hour before the door opened to admit the gentleman in question. Tall and fair, Austin bore an undeniable resemblance to the photograph of Ronald Marsden, and his accent was almost certainly that of a North American.
Take a seat, Mr. Study.
Oh, thank you.
Well, now then, what seems to be the trouble?
Well, I'm not quite sure how to begin this, but does the name Marsden mean anything to you? Ronald Marsden?
Marsden? No, not offhand. Why?
Well, take a look at this photograph.
Good Lord.
Yes, that was taken of Marsden in 1940, before he left Canada on his way over here to serve in the Air Force. Now, on March the 16th, 1942, he was shot down over France, reported dead, never heard of again. Until a couple of weeks back. His father, who's now in London on business, thought he saw him coming out of Charing Cross Station.
This is incredible. Mr. Study, you've just solved the problem I'd given up all hope of ever solving.
Huh?
The problem of my true identity. You've told me who I am.
It would be difficult to say which of the two men was the more bewildered as they faced each other across the lawyer's desk. Study's expression was one of blank surprise, the other's of intense relief and gratitude mingled with puzzled anxiety. For several seconds that seemed more like minutes, neither spoke, until at length the silence was broken by the latter.
There's not much to my side of the story, Mr. Study. In June 1942, I woke up in a hospital in Paris, a hospital staffed by Germans. I had no idea who I was or how I'd got there. My memory was a complete blank, and it's remained so ever since. All the Germans could tell me was that I was picked up wandering along a village street on the outskirts of Rouen.
You weren't carrying identification?
No.
What about your clothes?
All I had on was a pair of leather shorts and a Hessian shirt. How I came by them, I wouldn't know. The most likely explanation is that I stole them. But where or from whom is anyone's guess. I felt perfectly fit and I'd suffered no external injuries, but my mind was a total void. It was like being born all over again.
And what did they do with you, the Germans?
They put me to work on an orchard, and there I stayed till the liberation forces arrived. Then I was brought back to England, put into a hospital again for almost a year, during which time I was attended by some of the best brain specialists in the country. But they couldn't do any more for me than the German doctors had. The only thing I discovered about myself when I was there was that I possessed an unaccountable knowledge of law. I read a number of legal books and found many of the texts were familiar. That's how I came to embark on my present profession. I was given a grant to attend law school. In 2 years, I qualified, and in 1949, I was received at the bar.
The name Barnett Austin, where'd that come from?
Curiously enough, it was given to me by one of the German orderlies. He thought I was an American, and the only American he'd ever met was a man called Austin Barnett. So he reversed it to Barnett Austin and conferred it on me. I've kept it ever since. Actually, it's now my legal name, secured by deed poll.
And the authorities weren't able to place you at all, eh?
No, they weren't even sure where I came from. The popular conception was that I was a Canadian, but one or two so-called experts stated that my accent was definitely Bostonian. Then to cap it off, there was a suggestion that I might be from the West Country.
You made no private inquiries?
Oh, hundreds, but the results only served to confuse me further. In the end, I just gave up.
You don't recall being in the Air Force or anything like that, eh?
No recollection of it, whatever. As for being shot down, let alone being reported dead, well, it sounds just like you're talking about someone else. But before we go any further, would you mind filling me in a little on my background? What family do I have? Am I married or single? What part of Canada do I come from?
Well, I think your father's the guy to answer those questions. Oh, you're not married, though. You can rest easy there. Oh,
thank God for that, at least. I don't know. It's all come so suddenly. I'm rather at a loss to express my feelings.
Don't bother trying. Just relax while I phone your father. Oh, before I forget, better hang on to this coin for luck. You've done okay by it so far. It may come in handy again.
Henry Simon returns to conclude this story in just a moment. And here again is Henry Simon.
To round off this story, I can only theorize. The one possible explanation for Ronald Marsden's survival would seem to be that he did actually bail out of his plane before it exploded, unseen by his two comrades, and that, in landing on French soil, he suffered a head injury, which deprived him of his memory. Whether or not he has since regained it, of course, I couldn't say. But I do happen to know that he returned to Toronto with his father in the hope that familiar surroundings might succeed, where medical treatment had apparently failed. A truly astonishing case. One, indeed, which surely bears out the old adage that truth is much stranger than fiction. And now, this is Henry Simon, inviting you, as always, to meet me here again, and for the present, bidding you au revoir.